Hello, I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to The Buzz. This week, every book ever written online.
If you scanned a page every second, it would take 100 years to get to 1 million books, and it'll take 10,000 years to get to 100 million books.
Yeah, it's quite a task, and we'll hear more about it later in the show. But we begin this week with a tragic anniversary.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended. Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible.
U.S. President George W. Bush speaking after a wave of attacks struck at the heart of America's military, economic and political establishment. Good morning, John Logan with ABC News. The once towering World Trade Center in New York...
2,792 people died in the attack on the World Trade Center, and the job of identifying them went to the office of the Chief Medical Examiner of New York City. The sheer size of the task prompted the doctors to ring Howard Cash, founder of Gene Codes, a bioinformatics company with a well-regarded DNA sequencing program. That phone call changed Howard Cash's life and led Gene Codes to develop a new kind of identification software called Mass Fatality Identification System, or EMPHASIS. Here's Howard Cash.
Actually, when I got that phone call, I thought that the medical examiner was going to ask us to donate some of the software that we've been selling to laboratories for the previous dozen years. And, of course, I was completely prepared to donate copies. But they were very insistent that we should come to New York, and I had no idea what the level of the problem was until I got there.
Because the situation's actually more complicated than just possibly 20,000 people dead, isn't it? It was more than enormous numbers.
Yes, there was an enormous number of fragments. To date, it's coincidental you picked that number, but 20,000 remains, just about, have been recovered for those 2,700 people. But the other thing to consider is that not only were they fragmented, but they were out in the elements. They were on a pile of rubble with heavy equipment going across it on a pile of burning jet fuel, soaked in water while people were trying to put out those jet fuel fires. The amount of compromise, the amount of damage done to the human tissue that was left was enormous.
And some people, some individuals, were in as many as 200 pieces.
That's true. There were something over 200 intact bodies, more or less, maybe with injuries, and people in many pieces, and I think in the most extreme case, I can't say the worst case, they were all terrible. Someone was in about 200 pieces.
I also remember reading shortly afterwards that you had examples of bone from one person being found inside tissue from another person, just to really complicate things.
That's true, and you remember there are 210-story skyscrapers that came down. One of the striking things about Ground Zero for those who worked there, not even as much what was found, but what wasn't found, is 20% of all the office space in Manhattan on the ground, and there was no office furniture, no computers, no desks, no doors. So you can imagine what it did to the people, and not only were they torn to pieces by falling steel and reinforced concrete, but they were commingled. A lot of effort was taken to try and make sure as remains came to the morgue. The anthropologist, who was the first to review them, would try and ensure that nothing went into a body bag that could possibly be more than one person, but it really wasn't always possible to tell.
All of this massive destruction meant that the usual methods of identifying people, I'm thinking of fingerprints and dental records in particular, only took you so far.
That's true. There were quite a few people who were identified initially, or maybe parts of the remains were identified initially by fingerprints or dental records. But when I say something specific, I hope your listeners won't think I'm being disrespectful to the memories of the people killed, but there's no other way to communicate the information. If you find somebody's leg or an individual vertebrae, there are no fingerprints, there are no teeth to work with.
Now, there was DNA analysis done, and there were already some large DNA analysis programs kind of in operation fairly quickly afterwards.
Well, the first attempts were using something called CODIS. It was developed by the FBI here in the States and is widely used elsewhere in the country for matching DNA fingerprints, as they're commonly called, for crime scenes.
DNA fingerprints, these are brief stretches out of the 3 billion bases that make up our DNA that repeat over and over, and it's matching these at different locations on the DNA, isn't it?
Right. So at a particular one of these locations, each of us will have two copies of this stretch of DNA, one from our mother, one from our father. And depending on these short tandem repeats, you'll remember, you know, from high school that DNA is made up of kind of four building blocks, A, C, G, and T. And you can spell anything, make any gene from those four letters, like you can make any English book by combining the 26 letters of our alphabet. But these short repeats might say ACTT, 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 ACTT. And when I measure how long that stretch of DNA is, I might find out that I got 12 from one of my parents and 15 from another parent. And at that same location, you got 9 from one parent and 20 from your other parent. And then we check 13 of those locations. So it's like a combination lock that instead of turning 3 times right to left, you turn 13 times. The chances of any two people having the whole combination identical, other than identical twins, is about 1 in 200 or 500 trillion.
That would seem to be fairly comprehensive. What was the limitation of using DNA fingerprinting when it came to identifying victims of September the 11th?
Well, the good thing about this kind of DNA that comes in the nucleus of every cell is that it's very, very specific, just like I described. The downside is it's rather fragile, and it'll start to break down when you die. It'll certainly start to break down when human remains are exposed to temperatures in the area of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, where jet fuel was burning in a enclosed area. So it began to degrade. We might only get a few of the numbers. Maybe of the 13 locations we tried, we might only get 2 or 3 or 5. Now, that's not enough specificity to say in a population of almost 3,000 missing people that we know for sure who this person is. So we had to go to extra efforts to get a little more information to give us enough certainty to return remains to a family so they could have a proper burial.
Your approach was to build an analysis program that could handle more than one type of information about DNA.
Right. When we started out, we had several goals. Two immediate problems were, one, how do we combine different types of tests, and how do we reduce the size of the haystack we were looking for by finding, to use your example, someone in 200 pieces and not have to look at that 200 times. So the first step was to say when remains, even if we don't know who they are clearly one and the same person, to kind of collapse that into a kind of a representative record. For that record, we wanted to add several different kinds of tests. The STRs, the short tandem repeats that are commonly called DNA fingerprints, was the one we tried first. There's another kind of DNA in every cell, and it's more plentiful, called mitochondrial DNA. The mitochondria is a little organ inside every cell. There are actually maybe 500 of these little organs in every cell. They're the power plant of the cell.
Yeah, they generate the energy that all cells run on, don't they?
Absolutely. And they have a little bit of DNA of their own, but instead of 3 billion characters, it's about 16,500 characters in a little circle. It's circular, it's smaller, it's tougher. It's hardy material, and you can usually get mitochondrial DNA out of a mummy. It's very likely to last. So sometimes when the nuclear DNA that would be used for a fingerprint had degraded beyond where it could be recovered in the lab, the mitochondrial DNA still survived.
But
that's the good news.
The thing about mitochondrial DNA, though, is we only inherit it from our mothers.
That's true. You don't get it from both parents. And the other thing is that it's just not as specific.
Yeah, because it's so much shorter, you're dealing with so much less of it.
Yep. It doesn't have those short tandem repeats. We look at individual character differences that just have diverged over the course of the fairly short course of human evolution. And you only get it from one parent, so it doesn't continually get recombined, as you said. The result is the most common pattern that's found in that mitochondrial circle of DNA is found in about 7% of the Caucasian population, and that's not enough to make an ID. It might be enough to exclude somebody. So if based on a partial STR, a partial fingerprint, we could say, well, we know it has to be one of these three people who share those locations. And if the mitochondrial can exclude two of them, because two of them don't match and one of them does, well, that might be enough to return somebody to their family.
So your program, in effect, tries to build up a virtual individual for each person you're trying to identify, and you put in the DNA profiling information, and then if you can't exclude someone, you add the mitochondrial analysis. Mm-hmm. But that isn't going to get you everyone, is it? That is still going to leave you with a large number of people whom you're just not sure about.
At that point now, as of the 2,792 people who died as of 6:40 this morning, only 1,524 of those people have been identified, so only a little more than half. Some will never be found. We'll try to find everybody, but we're effectively cremated, and there may not be anything left to find. But for those who are, we want to try everything available in the lab, and the third technology that's being applied is a technology that came out of the Human Genome Project called SNPs, stands for Single Nucleotide Polymorphism. instead of looking at a length of DNA, you're interrogating a single character and saying, are you a G, an A, a T, or a C? And you may only need about 50 or 60 characters in a row that are intact to do that test. So even if the DNA is badly broken up, we might still be able to get some information that way.
Right, because we know that there is a sequence over this 50 or 60 characters, and at some point, though, you get a replacement of one letter by another letter.
Yeah. The ones that we study are ones that are known to vary. These are specific spots that, through all the study by all the biologists around the world, at that particular position, one of two characters is found. It's either, in our case, it's either a C or it's a T. A's and G's are never found. So when we look at it, we'll find that in every case, that position, the person has a C or a T or a C and a T, one from each parent. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for someone who has that same pattern. And you can look at inheritance from the parents with this the same way you do with normal nuclear DNA.
What are the chances of identifying someone incorrectly when you have all of this together and with your analysis program, you're able to kind of layer one of these, each of these on top of the other?
Well, that question is asked a lot. There are some things that could lead to a wrong answer that involve some incoming information that's wrong. But how sure we have to be actually is a policy decision. There's a statistical chance of inheriting certain characteristics from each parent. And the decision that was made at the beginning of this project by the chief medical examiner in the city of New York was that the certainty of a direct match, matching the DNA from remains that were found at the site to pre-existing patterns, like we might have gotten DNA from somebody's toothbrush. How sure do we have to be about the match? Well, it had to be 10 to the 10th or better. Less than one chance in 10 to the 10th that this would have occurred anywhere else in the population, anywhere in the world, based on the populations that we know. And there are two ways we can identify someone, by comparing their DNA to a known sample of their DNA collected before they died. That's getting DNA from their toothbrush or from an old surgical sample. The other thing is to compare their DNA to the DNA of their parents or their children or their siblings. Kinship comparisons are inherently less specific, and they therefore require more points of reference. You'd like to have both parents. For kinship, the threshold set by the chief medical examiner is we have to be 99.9% sure, and with only one potential match in all the known profiles. Remember, in a population of 3,000 victims, if you were 99% sure, that means it could still be any of 30 people. So now we're narrowing it down to at least to no more than one in three, and it can't match anybody else. It can't be a possibility to match anyone else. And because that's still a little fuzzy, we require that we identify somebody by at least two different modes of identification, maybe by a direct match in kinship or by a partial dental record and a DNA match.
Because a false positive, when you ID someone and tell their family that you have, and that later turns out to be wrong, that would be a disaster, wouldn't it?
That is my greatest nightmare. The worst case is not that somebody won't be identified, although that is terrible for that family. The worst case is someone is identified, a funeral is held, and a mistake was made.
Now, all software that I've ever encountered in my life gets upgraded. Have you been able to tweak this program over the last 2 years?
We released the first version on December 13th, 2001. We were hired effectively on October 8th. So in a couple of months, we put the first version together. Between September 11th and December 13th, 105 identifications have been made by DNA. The day we turned the program on for the first time, we found 55 new matches that had not been found before, just because it was too big a mountain of information to look through. That turned out to be positive IDs. Since then, almost every single week we've released an upgrade. That requires an enormous level of testing. Releasing live production code every week is impossible, but this whole project was impossible.
So you're up to sort of the 60th or 70th or beyond iteration now?
I think we're in our 80s at this point. We have some disciplines. We have all of our engineers have to write, before they start working on a new feature that's been requested by the medical examiner, they have to write the test that feature will pass so we can run it through an automated test to make sure that it works. And that has to be approved by our QA department. Then when they make those changes, before they can put into the final program, it has to pass that test, and the whole program has to pass every other test that's been written since the beginning of time, which for us is about the middle of October 2001. And so there are about 2,000, or there are more than 2,000 automated tests that get run 12 or 16 times every single day. It's very tough to make a fix in one part of the program and break another part of the program without it becoming very obvious to everybody.
Now, Howard, this is not your core business. This has grown like Topsy to take over your company, but you're not really making money out of this, are you?
Our main business was a product called Sequencher. It's just a commercial software program used by laboratory biologists. We were involved with the Human Genome Project. We had a lot of every major pharmaceutical company in the world uses that software. We took all of our engineers and our entire QA department, except for one tester, one QA person, and one engineer, off of Sequencher and put everything we had, plus everybody we could hire, onto nothing but the World Trade Center. And originally, we thought we'd be on this for 10 to 12 months, and now it looks like we'll be on it for maybe a full 3 years. When we started the project, 100% of our staff and all 11 of our shareholders agreed that we would not try and profiteer on this project, and we said we'd do it at gut cost or as close to it as we could. In the end, now 2 years in, and looking at 3 years, we're actually making more than we're spending, so there is a kind of a line profit on it. The real cost to us is that our main business, the thing that we'll still be paying our payrolls when the World Trade Center effort is finished, has not been updated. We haven't done an update in 2 years, and you know it's axiomatic in the software business, if you will. You don't make money selling software, you make money selling upgrades. We're not doing any upgrades. So when that tap gets turned off in the city of New York, we're going to have to scramble a little bit. But every single person on the staff here would do it again in a heartbeat.
The software you came up with, though, It occurs to me it can be used in other mass disasters too. There are earthquakes and hurricanes every single year.
The earthquakes and hurricanes, the Australian Federal Police Laboratory was very involved in the recovery from the Bali bombing in November 2002. Jim Robertson and Lindsay Wilson-Wild at the AFP in Canberra, I visited them in December of last year, and we kind of compared our experiences and hope to build something better out of both of our experiences so that the next people don't have to start from scratch.
Well, Howard, thanks very much for joining us on The Buzz. We really appreciate it.
Glad to talk with you.
Howard Cash is president of Gene Codes Forensics in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This is The Buzz, our weekly technology show on Radio National and Radio Australia. I'm Richard Adey. Imagine for a moment if you could have instant access to all human knowledge anywhere in the world. Well, it's going to be possible, according to Raj Reddy, Professor of Computer Science and Robotics at Carnegie Mellon University. And the first step along the way is the Million Book Digital Library Project, a modest proposal to put a million books online.
Now we are beginning to scan books in multiple languages. And so by the end of this year, because of this project, we will have 100,000 books online. And in the next year or two, we should get to a million book point.
Let's work out the scale of the enterprise. How many books are there in existence?
They may not be in existence, but we estimate from the time the Gutenberg press was invented, there are probably about 100 million books that have been printed and published in all the languages, of which there is only a record of 42 million books in the OCLC catalog.
OCLC?
It's a catalog, a union of all the books that are in all the libraries in the United States and other countries, some of the other participating countries. So we think there are 100 million books. And if you read a book, you know, every day from the time you're born to the time you die, you can only read about 40,000 books. There's no way you would be able to read all the books, you know, even a million books in a lifetime.
If we're going to have there's 100,000 available by the end of the year.
Right.
And a million is, I guess, the short-term aim.
Right.
What about being ambitious and going for the 100 million in the long term?
That's exactly where we need to go. But it turns out, if you scan the page every second, it will take 100 years to get to a million books. And it will take 10,000 years to get to 100 million books. So that's the magnitude of the problem. So instead of scanning one page every second, you have to scan 100 pages every second so that you can get the 101 million books in 1 year instead of 100 years. Fortunately, this task is infinitely parallelizable. If every student in the world would scan one book, the whole thing would be done in a week because there are about 100 million students that are attending schools. And if each one would do one book, we are done, okay? But the issue is logistics and coordination and finding and getting the book into the scanning centers and so on, which is time consuming.
So what are the technical challenges that have to be solved to make this a realistic prospect?
The technical challenges are twofold. One is, when you take a book, unless you cut it up, there's a curvature. So when you image a book with curved pages, characters change shape, and so that's not very convenient. And if you try to now recognize those characters with OCR systems, they'll make a lot of errors. But there's image processing technology which would automatically convert a curved page into a flat page. And so there are other things, like when you scan a page, it's slightly tilted, or your thumbprints are there, or some other noise is there. Removing the noise and cleaning it up takes substantial effort. Once you've done all of that, now you have to do optical character recognition so that those words are recognizable and searchable by computers than simply looking at a photograph or an image of the page. And so that's where some of the technical challenges are right now. But there are research challenges. Let's say you have those books already online. Turns out, once you get all the books of the world online, 1 billion people might access it every day. The scalability of the enterprise, that has nothing to do with the content, is that once it is there, connectivity, global connectivity at high bandwidths, and being able to ask a multilingual information retrieval, where you ask a question in one language, retrieves answers in all languages, and then converts it back to that language so that the person that asked it is able to read it. So those are currently unsolved problems, and they will be solved over the next 10, 20 years because they're interesting research problems. Similarly, there's the problem of what we call summarization. It turns out, if I give you a book and say, read this book and write a 10-page summary, you'll do a good job. But we don't have a computer that can do the same thing yet. And this is what we call an AI complete problem. We don't know how to solve it. We don't have computers that can truly understand written English or written French or written whatever well enough to translate or summarize and give you the information like a human being seems to be able to do. But there are systems that will do 80% good job or 50% good job. But if all that you're trying to do is find something that's related to your interests and retrieve it, and then you can spend more time, if you want, manually translating it.
Now, that's some of the technical challenges, certainly not all of them that would be faced, but it occurs to me there's going to be other sorts of challenges too. I'm thinking of something like copyright. There's going to be issues of copyright and, I guess, other policy concerns that will have to be solved.
We have technical challenges, we have research challenges, and then we have policy challenges. The policy challenges are, the main one is the copyright problem. It turns out, of the 100 million books, about 92 million are out of print, but still in copyright. That means nobody can access them. So the policy question is, are there new policies governments of the world can promulgate which would have the effect of compensating the authors and the creators of these works, and at the same time make it available for the public good? Right now, it's out of print, nobody's making any money on it, but still in copyright, so nobody can access it. So it's a lose-lose proposition. So we need to come up with a win-win proposition where the authors get a tax break, and if all of a sudden their book becomes very popular, maybe they should also get paid on the basis of usage. If your book is checked out 10,000 times, maybe you should get a check for $10 or $100 or something from the government. And since we already spend billions of dollars on physical libraries, setting aside some of that money to compensating the authors seems to make eminent sense. And finally, making it possible for individuals to automatically contribute their new books and be able to get slightly higher payment every time it's downloaded. And it's not limited to books only. Newspapers are already online, and you want to be able to get at them. Radio, NPR, is already putting all of their broadcasts online, so I can listen to it later, except it's not always transcribed, so I can't search for it.
You'll be pleased to know that The Buzz is always transcribed. You can search for this interview you're doing right now.
Okay.
Where are we with the project? I mean, in terms of how much it'll cost and who's going to need to contribute and participate. What's happening now?
So the costs are, if we try to do it in US or in Australia, it'll cost, to do 1 million books, it'll cost $100 million to $200 million. But what we have done is made it a joint project between US, India, and China. And India and China are providing the manpower at their cost. And US is providing the computers. And so, you know, I'm sure Australia and Europe will join in at some point.
I saw you talking to the minister, Richard Alston. Have you been twisting his arm on this?
Yes, I said Australia has a unique opportunity to take a leadership role and say, if you are an author of a book that's still in copyright but out of print, if you submitted it to this nonprofit activity, you can take a tax deduction, and we'll also give you an annual payment based on the amount of usage.
How long is it going to take? You said perhaps 5 to 10 years to get 1 million books.
Right.
But 100 million books, if we go back to Gutenberg, well, give us some dates.
The current plan is if we can get about 10 million books in the next 10 to 20 years, then that will become such an important resource for the world that everybody will start using it, and then it'll build on itself. More importantly, all the new books, which are born digital already, can go right in, and we don't have to do anything. And so the access costs are much, much smaller.
And 100 million in the long term, are you prepared to put a date on it?
Yeah, 100 million by 2200. How is that? In 100 years, I think we'll be there.
It boggles the mind. Raj Reddy from the Million Book Digital Library Project. And that's it for this week. Remember, our website's at abc.net.au/rn, and click on The Buzz. Our email address is thebuzz@your.abc.net.au. The show's producer is Sue Clark, technical production by John Diamond. I'm Richard Adie. Thanks for listening.